Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Top officials from Governor Kathy Hochul's office are traveling New York to promote her budget priorities. This week, Secretary of State Walter Mosley visited three North Country communities where he talked about Hochul's affordability agenda. He also shed light on how President Trump's promised crackdown on immigration impacts New York's Office of New Americans. The New York Public News Network's Emily Russell reports.
A few dozen people gathered earlier this week inside a classroom at North Country Community College in Saranac Lake. There were representatives from Adirondack groups like the APA, ANCA, Roost, and ORDA. They were there to see Secretary of State Walter Mosley. Mosley was acting as a surrogate for Governor Kathy Hochul and her budget proposals, which include middle-class tax cuts, free school meals for all students, and inflation refund checks.
So for the first time ever, the Inflation Refund Initiative, billions of dollars will go back to 8.6 million New Yorkers who make less than $300,000 a year. For the North Country, the inflation refund would benefit 163,000 families.
Mosley also highlighted Hochul's budget priorities that focus on child care, housing, and workforce development. Lawmakers in Albany are in session right now, ironing out their own budget priorities. A final state spending plan is due by April 1st. At his stops in Watertown and Saranac Lake this week, Mosley also introduced people to his own responsibilities as Secretary of State. His office oversees the Downtown Revitalization Initiative, the Consumer Protection Division, and the Office for New Americans, which helps connect immigrants with legal and other services.
We have many resources in place for immigrants looking for a pathway to citizenship, and we'll continue to invest in those resources and services.
There are more than 670,000 undocumented immigrants living in New York. That's according to the latest data from the Center for Migration Studies. President Donald Trump has promised a severe crackdown on undocumented immigrants in the U.S. in his second term of his presidency. More than 100 people in the New York City area were recently arrested as part of that crackdown. After his presentation in Saranac Lake, Secretary of State Walter Mosley said the governor has and will work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement on helping detain immigrants who have broken criminal laws.
We're going to continue to work with ICE when it is necessary. So when we're talking about capturing a criminal fugitive, someone who has broken the law, penal law, someone who is a violent offender, someone who wishes to do harm to others.
But Mosley described it as a delicate situation. He drew a distinction between an immigrant who has broken a criminal law and someone whose sole offense is being undocumented.
We have people who are undocumented, but not violent offenders, not criminals, who have children to raise and have who are caregivers of others and who also contribute to our economy.
The Office for New Americans, which Mosley oversees as Secretary of State, has provided services to more than 750,000 people since it was created in 2012. Mosley said while the office hasn't seen a notable uptick in requests for help since Trump took office last month, he said the sentiment from people has changed.
Folks just don't know what is taking place and, you know, what policies are going to be pushed by the administration and what's going to stick, what's not going to stick. So there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of trepidation, and you feel it. It's palpable.
Mosley said the Office for New Americans will continue to focus on helping immigrants in New York find pathways to citizenship. In Saranac Lake, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
The father of a man who was killed in a Utica area prison is calling for justice. Robert Ricks spoke with lawmakers at the state capitol this week and says he wants prison reform and accountability for the officers involved in his son's death. Jung Yoon Han from the New York Public News Network has more.
Robert Ricks was proud of his 43-year-old son, Robert Brooks, for what he was accomplishing in prison. He got a GED, he was learning sign language, and took horticulture classes. Rick says he wanted to celebrate those accomplishments with his son, but he didn't get the chance.
I don't know what to say. I witnessed my son being murdered on video.
Brooks' death at the hands of correctional officers at Marcy Correctional Facility in December has prompted calls for prison reform. Rick says that change is vital for healing.
What I'd like to see change is the people that are sentenced to prison, that they come home and they get a chance to be the best people that they're capable of being, that they go to prison and they come out better, that they don't come out in body bags.
Officials have yet to arrest any correctional officers involved in the death, which examiners ruled as a homicide earlier this month. Standing with Ricks, State Senator Julia Salazar says that delay is unacceptable.
I'm dismayed by how long this process has taken. It's been over 2 months since Robert Brooks was killed, and arrests have not been made.
Salazar is one of several state lawmakers proposing prison reform bills in the wake of Brooks's death. He's being advised by former State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. In Albany, I'm Jung Yoon Han for the New York Public News Network.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Alice Bufkin, Associate Executive Director for Policy and Advocacy at the Citizens Committee for Children of New York, which is part of the Campaign for Healthy Minds, Healthy Kids, a coalition of behavioral health, mental health, and substance abuse providers, advocates, and families. The coalition held a rally this week at the Capitol asking lawmakers to ensure that all children and adolescents in New York receive the high-quality behavioral health services they need.
Our campaign this year has two primary issues that we're really fighting for. So the first of these is we are seeking a $195 million investment in the state budget to address what is a really severe waitlist crisis that's plaguing children and families seeking these mental health and substance use disorder services. So we're talking about children who are waiting for weeks, for months, for years sometimes, in order to get the care they need. And these are services that they need desperately. These are not things that can wait. These are not services that can wait. And we know that the reason we have such a severe waitlist crisis is we have a widespread provider shortage throughout the state. We just don't have the number of professionals we need to serve children. And that's what's making them wait. That's what's making families wait. And that's what's making them experience all the different repercussions that happen when your child is waiting for services that they desperately need. And so with this $195 million investment, we could actually add 1,300 additional behavioral health professionals to the state and serve 26,000 additional children. So we view that as a first step towards actually reversing course on where the state is and actually enhancing capacity and really targeting these wait lists that families and children are facing. So that's our first ask, and that's really related to the Medicaid system. So really making sure that our Medicaid services, and specifically outpatient services, which are really those kind of frontline, early upstream preventive services, are funded adequately. Again, these are the kinds of services that you need to get to children early, because if they don't get the care they need early, we see their needs become more complex and more acute. They end up cycling in and out of emergency rooms and hospitals. They end up with involvement in the police because they don't have adequate support in their schools and communities. We see them ending up in residential treatment settings. We don't want any of those long-term impacts. We want children to get care as early as possible. And so we're really fighting to make sure that the state is investing upstream in children and families. So that's our first priority. Our second priority is more related to the commercial insurance side. So in New York, there is actually no requirement that commercial plans cover the full array of mental health and SUD services that children need. So let's say you are a parent and you think you have commercial insurance through your work, and you pick up the phone, you try to call for these services, and you discover that actually your plan just doesn't cover the care that your child needs. There's no requirement that they do so. And so what we are seeking is to require the commercial plans to cover the same array of mental health and substance use disorder services that Medicaid does. And we think through that parity, we can really start to address the challenges many of these families are facing in accessing services.
Can you put a face on this for us? Can you tell us about one story about a child and what's happened? Also, I see that the statistics are dire when you say there's short staffing. You know, give us some more numbers on, for example, psychiatrists available across the state.
Yes, I'd be happy to. I mean, so Helping Minds Help the Kids in recent months has conducted a really broad array of surveys and studies to really identify the depth of the need in the state. And honestly, it's really difficult to overestimate how challenging it is in the state to access care and what the repercussions are for families. So in the first of one of these studies that HMHK conducted, we contracted with a group called Health Management Associates. And what this study does is it looks at the gap between the number of children who need outpatient services and those who are actually receiving them. So again, outpatient services are these array of really upstream preventive services. A child will live at home while they're getting treatment as opposed to needing to be hospitalized overnight or staying overnight in a residential setting for weeks or months. These are really frontline services. And unfortunately, when this study was conducted, the gap between the number of children who need care and those who are actually getting it is enormous. We found that at best, 1 in 4 children and adolescents needing outpatient care are receiving them. That means that 3 in 4 children are not getting the types of preventive services they need. So that's one area where we, obviously, there's an enormous crisis in access.
That's Alice Bufkin, Associate Executive Director for Policy and Advocacy at the Citizens Committee for Children of New York and part of the Campaign for Healthy Minds, Healthy Kids. You're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. A bill introduced in the New York State Legislature this week would make it easier for municipalities to opt into rent control. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports.
Under the current Emergency Tenant Protection Act, which was expanded to include communities outside New York City in 2019, any municipality can declare a housing emergency and opt into rent control if a study finds its apartment vacancy rate to be less than 5%. A new bill sponsored by Senator Brian Kavanaugh and Assemblymember Sarah Hannah Shrestha, both Democrats, would nix that requirement. Kavanaugh says the Rent Emergency Stabilization for Tenants, or REST Act, would allow upstate communities to opt in based on a variety of factors, including a vacancy study or publicly available data like the eviction rate and homeless shelter population.
A lot of local governments don't have the resources to do kind of a rigorous survey like that with their own local resources.
New York, like many states, is grappling with a housing crisis that has driven up market rents. Multiple cities have tried to implement rent control since 2019, but only Kingston has had any success. Poughkeepsie and Newburgh's vacancy studies were both challenged and struck down in court. Kingston is still mired in litigation over its vacancy study from 2022, even as it plans to conduct a new one this year. The Hudson Valley Property Owners Association, which has been party to these lawsuits, says cities are manipulating housing studies to make it look like their vacancy rates are lower than they really are. But it maintains studies are still the most objective way to measure housing emergencies. Executive Director Rich Lanzarone equates the REST Act with, quote, draconian overreach.
It's an assault on the mom-and-pop landlords from Buffalo to Montauk.
If lawmakers want to tackle the housing crisis, Lanzarone says they should focus on building more housing, not restricting landlords. He says measures like rent control place an unfair burden on smaller landlords and disincentivize future development.
Once you're ensnared in this, the state is constantly asking for reports. So in Kingston, we have a retired property owner, 80 years old, a retired plumber. Does his own work, he keeps his property very well, but he's totally computer illiterate. And the state requires these reports to be filed by computer only. Now they've fined him like $14,000 because he's late on filing his reports. Who would want to be a landlord in New York State? You'd have to be out of your mind.
In addition to changing how cities opt in, the REST Act would allow rent control to apply to more units. Currently, the ETPA only applies to buildings built before 1974 with more than 6 units. Shrestha from the 103rd District says that isn't realistic for smaller communities upstate.
Lots of localities just don't have big buildings with a lot of units. You know, that might be more common in New York City. It's not common everywhere. The law is stuck in 1974 because that's when it was first passed. But we want to bring it in line to what we did with good cause eviction, which is exempting only buildings that were built in the last 15 years on a rolling basis.
Good cause eviction restricts landlords from evicting tenants without a legitimate cause. Many cities have opted into good cause eviction. Binghamton passed a resolution Wednesday, joining Ithaca, Albany, Kingston, Poughkeepsie, Beacon, Newburgh, and Croton-on-Hudson. The city of Middletown has scheduled a public hearing on good cause eviction for March 4th. Kavanaugh says it's clear local officials want to step in on issues like eviction and rent. He hopes the REST Act can help them do that.
When you ask New Yorkers, are we having a housing crisis? They don't say, well, we have to measure the vacancy rate and determine that it's under 5%, and then we'll know whether we have a housing crisis. They look at the condition of the housing that's available to them. So this is mostly about modernizing the standard, recognizing that local governments make choices based on a variety of factors all the time.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The candidates, the voters, and Hakeem Jeffries are among those wondering when New York State will set a special election in the race to replace North Country Congresswoman Elise Stefanik. Stefanik will be leaving to become U.N. ambassador, but with a narrow GOP majority in the House and state Democrats' apparent urge to keep the seat open for months, it's unclear what will happen next. The Legislative Gazette's Ian Pickett sat down with Capitol Press Room host David Lombardo of WCNY, who broke the news that the state legislature was considering changing the law around special elections.
So just remind us of the timeline. This all happened in a matter of days. There was a conversation about a bill, then there was a bill, then there was no bill.
Yeah, so if we can remember far enough back to January 31st, those simpler days, I got a heads up that there was a unscheduled conference. That's when the majority party meets, and this was one for the Assembly and Senate. They were meeting on a Friday, and it turned out that they were considering updating the special election calendar in New York. And right now, the special election calendar is governed by pretty specific laws that set the timelines for when the governor needs to declare a special election and when that special election needs to be held. Well, nothing ended up emerging from those initial conversations on January 31st, except a recognition by the Democratic majorities that, yes, we are considering that. Well, fast forward to the first week of February, February 7th, and they met again. And this time they did produce a bill, and they had a concrete legislation that was dropped late Friday. And this time the Democratic majorities in both houses of the legislature were prepared to talk about that bill to a certain degree. And we had a proposal on what the new calendar might look like now, written down in concrete terms.
Then by Monday, there were some press conferences by Republicans blasting the idea. The Congressman Mike Lawler, who is expected to run for governor, said it was a RICO case and should be investigated. Then there was no vote. So what happened?
So as soon as that bill dropped, the pushback really started pushing, I guess, for lack of a better expression. We reached out to the majority leader in the Senate, Andrea Stewart Cousins, her office, as well as Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie's office to get comments, and they were explaining to us why they supported it. But we are also reaching out to the Senate Republican leader, and they gave a fiery statement about what the problem was here, and that just sort of cascaded. It was like a snowball, and as more people became aware of it, more opposition mounted, including some within the Democratic Party, largely from assembly members whose districts overlap with the 21st congressional district currently represented by Elise Stefanik. And it clearly, as we can get to, became something that grabbed the attention of the White House.
And we should say at this point, there is a Democratic candidate chosen for this race. There is not a Republican candidate. So a lot of the potential candidates also had a chance to weigh in.
Yeah, including Assemblymember Chris Tague. He's a Republican from Schoharie County. He's pursuing the nomination, so to speak. I'd say really
the designation
of the committee chairs. Yeah, because it's an interesting process. But I think what ultimately moved the state lawmakers not to bring this up was Governor Kathy Hochul, who was seemingly swayed by her efforts to negotiate some other issues with the Republican White House and President Donald Trump.
Now, just as we're speaking, Governor Hochul was asked an interesting question by one of our colleagues in New York City, which is, hey, she won a special election for Congress back in 2011. Would it have been better if there had been longer run-up to that race? And here's what she had to say.
Hell yes. That was an awfully short time frame to have to run an election in seven counties. More time is very helpful for voters to get to know someone. I was known in one county out of seven. So I would just say there's a whole process, even the idea of having individuals not selected to a primary system. I mean, other states are doing it differently. Other states actually, 15 states allow up to 669 days to fill a vacancy, which is obscenely long. I wouldn't support that.
So there's some different conversations happening here. One reportedly between Hochul and Hakeem Jeffries, the House Minority Leader, and then another conversation between Hochul and President Trump over congestion pricing. It seems like the two are related.
They're definitely related, but I want to come back to what the governor was just talking about in these timelines for elections and her trying to make a case that, sure, you should have more time for elections. And you know what? Why don't we think about how we choose these candidates for special elections? This is not the first special election in New York. We had seats that had to get filled for Congress in 2024 on Long Island to replace George Santos, in Western New York to replace Brian Higgins. And no one at that time was saying, hey, why don't we wait until November when we could have more people participating, and it would cost the counties less money to administer these elections. And that sort of highlights that there is a blatant political thought process here, that Democrats are, one, writing off the special election, because if they thought that they could win it with smaller turnout, which is likely what you'd have in a special election, then we would be proceeding as planned. But there is a recognition from both sides of the aisle that this is a seat that will be in Republican hands, whether it's a special election this spring, this summer, or in November. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, they're not necessarily changing the calendar for that purpose. And this idea that we should be changing how we choose these candidates, I stumbled over my words earlier with how to describe Chris Tague. That's because special election candidates are chosen by county leaders within that district, as opposed to a primary, which is what good government groups want. They want a selection process that is not driven by political insiders. That is not part of this bill here. This reform, so to speak, is solely limited to time, and that's why it's really seen as a brazen political move. I believe Senate Minority Leader Robert Ort, in addition to brazen, called it craven.
The spokesperson for the Assembly Speaker, Carl Hastie, responding to Tague, said that it was meant to save money and get a better turnout. So I take it you don't give that argument too much truck.
I think they are correct that this would drive up turnout and it would save money, but it's not like, as I pointed out, they are suddenly aware of both of these factors with special elections. This is something they could have done in previous special elections and chose not to. So to say that you are currently motivated by those cost-saving and turnout concerns seems disingenuous to me. And I know that you would think that politicians and their spokespeople would be telling it to you straight 24/7 and really just wearing their heart on their sleeve, but sometimes you have to look for ulterior motives.
What do you think about the argument that, and I've heard a few people make it, that Democrats have so few cards to play right now, and Republicans in Washington have done much the same? You know, Merrick Garland is not on the Supreme Court, and so they should be playing like this because the Republicans haven't been playing by the rules of late either.
Yeah, I wouldn't put a value judgment on what Republicans have done in the past and what Democrats have done in the past, or what Republicans are doing now, what Democrats are doing now. But I would say from a Machiavellian perspective and a Machiavellian only perspective, there is a critique to be made against Democrats that they have not used all the bullets in their gun, so to speak, that they have unilaterally disarmed in a lot of situations. And I think this is kind of similar in the sense that the governor has basically preempted this conversation by directing the legislative leaders, according to good reporting by my colleagues at the Capitol, from even bringing this up as an issue. I mean, it's one thing to pass a bill. It's another thing to pass a bill and wait to sign it. It's another thing to pass a bill, wait to sign it, and then wait to actually implement it. Because this bill really gives the governor flexibility to choose when the special election is going to be. So this idea of just stopping the bill in its tracks in order to ensure you're on good terms with other issues seems to me like putting the safety on your gun, if I'm going to stick with these firearm metaphors, when you really could put one in the chamber, so to speak, and pass the bill now and be ready to fire if needed.
That's the Legislative Gazette's Ian Pickus speaking with Capitol Press Room host David Lombardo. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org. Or anywhere you get your podcasts, look for program number 2507. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.